My name's Anna Swinborne, and I'm delighted to welcome you here this evening. I'm an assistant curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and I am the lucky person who has chosen to curate the museum's exhibition celebrating the 100th anniversary of Pablo Picasso's Demoiselles d'Avignon. In conjunction with that exhibition, and in recognition of the fact that at the time that Picasso was working on Demoiselle, his closest friends and companions were writers and poets, we've invited four scholars who are poets themselves to come here and read a selection of works that either reflect on Picasso's painting or in some way evoke the artistic and cultural milieu in which it was created. There are extensive bios of these individuals in the program that was handed out to you, and let me just take this opportunity to thank each of them for coming. We are delighted to have you here. It's a great pleasure for us. Thank you. But before we begin, I would like to give you just a tiny bit of art historical context to help you imagine what it was like to be a young painter in Paris in 1907 and to tackle the subject of the nude or a group of nudes. Picasso had been living in Paris on and off in the first years of the century, but he didn't establish himself there permanently until 1904. And it was a pretty heady, creative time for the city's avant-garde. About a year before that, in 1903, a few of the Vanguard members had established the Salon d'Automne, which was intended to showcase innovation and developments in painting. It was also intended as an alternative to the conservative official Paris Salon, and also as an alternative to the more liberal but juryless Salon des Indépendants, which happened every spring. So in 1904, one of the exhibitors was Paul Cézanne, who himself painted bathers over and over again. And here I'm showing you an example of his from 1885 to 87, we think the date is. And it's currently in the Kunstmuseum in Basel. And Cézanne himself was nearing the end of his life and a very long painting career. But by that time in 1904, he was revered as a master, well, the master from Aix-en-Provence by the young vanguard. In addition to showing the work of living artists, the Salon d'Automne also every year hosted large retrospectives for artists from the past that they thought were influential and very important. In the year 1905, those two artists were Edward Manet and Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres. And I'm showing you an Ingres here called The Turkish Bath. It was painted in 1862. It's in the collection of the Louvre and gives you an example of his groups of bathers that he was very well known for. The following year, in 1906, they dedicated their retrospective to Paul Gauguin, who had died 3 years before in 1903 in the Marquesas. And here is his painting, Spirit of the Dead Watching, which was painted in 1892, and it's in the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo. So within just a few years that Picasso had been there, from early examples in the 19th century to more recent examples by Cézanne and Gauguin, Picasso saw the entire tradition as established by the masters of the nude. And he saw that tradition and had to grapple with it. But the other thing that we have to consider when we're thinking about art historical context is that of innovation, of what his contemporaries were doing, and in a lot of cases, specifically not doing with that tradition of the nude. Undoubtedly, the most important of these contemporaries was Henri Matisse. While we are pretty sure that Picasso and Matisse knew of each other's work by this point, we know that they didn't meet until the spring of 1906. Some people think that this meeting occurred when Gertrude Stein and two other members of her family brought Matisse to Picasso's studio to see this portrait that Picasso had painted of Gertrude in 1906. It's now in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Other people think that it happened in 1906 in March when Picasso visited the Salon des Indépendants, where Matisse was represented by only one painting, this painting here called the Bonheur de Vivre. And you should consider the fact that by the time of this exhibition, Matisse was pretty much established as the head of the Fauve movement, which had made its pretty scandalous debut the year before at the Salon d'Automne in 1905. And the Fauve painters at this time pretty much represented what was most ambitious and audacious in terms of young French painting. Okay. Picasso, as many of you know, was rather competitive and ambitious. And we know that he followed Matisse's innovations and his work very closely. The following year, in 1907, Matisse again delivered a very ambitious painting to the Salon des Indépendants. It's the one that I'm showing you on the right, called The Blue Nude, Memory of Biskra. And we know for a fact, actually, that Picasso saw this work. He was in the middle of painting Demoiselles d'Avignon, and that this specific painting had influenced him to change the second figure from the left. That figure had initially been in a seated pose that he had worked out in an earlier canvas, which we're lucky enough to have in the exhibition upstairs. When he saw Matisse's version of this, he changed her pose to a vertical version of the reclining pose. So I could go on for a long time and tell you about the dialogue that Picasso had with Matisse and how this influenced his painting, about the dialogues Picasso had with other young painters that he knew and that he saw regularly at the Stein Salon on Saturday evenings. But if I did, that would be a lecture, and you didn't come to hear me. So I'm going to introduce one of our readers, Marianne Cause, who is going to give a little bit of literary context before we turn to the actual reading of the pieces.
That was a great way to start. I like to think about Picasso among the poets. He was from the beginning one of those persons whom the poet Wallace Stevens defined as a man whose center is poetry, whether or not he's a poet. Poetry was for Stevens, and is for us, a matter of what he called exceptional concentration. It was and is what feels like being alive and intensifying that feeling. Picasso's painting and poetry do just that. We can speak of them and him in the present because he is quite surely a painter of and a poet of presence. I would love to be looking at Picasso. Okay. Furthermore, Picasso's great friends were, more even than Georges Braque and André Durin, the poets Max Jacob, Guillaume Apollinaire, Pierre Reverdy, and then Jean Cocteau, Paul Éluard, and Louis Aragon, all of whom I'll be quoting. He knew painting and did not need to know painters, as Gertrude Stein pointed out. So he lived among poets. He was to learn French through French poetry with Max Jacob. They would read each other French poetry at the Bateau Lavoir, where the Demoiselles d'Avignon was painted. And they had lunch in front of it, splashing various things upon it, it seems. Picasso was, as are many poets, deeply attracted to otherness, to border situations. So we find Picasso the Spaniard living in France, but near the Spanish border. We see Picasso the painter writing poems for a few months, but as a painter. Always he was trying something else, changing mode and form. He cared above all about knowing something new. This passion for knowing things and language as well as women defined him in all his intensity. He was a poet of and a party to whatever was without limit. If Picasso limited himself in anything, claimed the novelist and poet Randall Jarrell, he would not be Picasso. He loves the world so much he wants to steal it and eat it. And, adds the greatest surrealist poet of them all, Robert Desnos, Picasso used to tell a story about the Catalan, the restaurant on the Rue des Grands Augustins where he and the Bande à Picasso always had lunch. I'm quoting Picasso, as quoted by Desnos. I had lunched at the Catalan for months, and for months I looked at the sideboard without thinking more than, it's a sideboard. One day I decided to make a picture of it. I did. The next day, when I arrived, the sideboard had gone. Its place was empty. I must have taken it away without noticing by painting it. I'll end this brief introduction by quoting another borderline person involved always in the language of learning, Henry James. It's art which makes life, makes interest, makes importance, and I know of no substitute whatsoever for the force and beauty of its process. And this art, we could say, reading Picasso's poems and the poetry inspired, is as much poetry as painting. Now, we're going to be looking at that for a while. And when Picasso went to see the exhibition, it was an exhibition of African art at the Salon des Indépendants, he said, "I kept looking at the fetishes. I understood. I, too, am against everything. If we give form to the spirits, we become independent of them. Les Demoiselles d'Avignon must have come to me that day because it was my first canvas of exorcism." As André Breton said to Jacques Doucet, this is a letter which is quoted, thanks to Anna, at great length upstairs, and Breton trying to get Jacques Doucet, the couturier, to buy the Demoiselles d'Avignon, said to him, "Here is the painting which one would parade as they paraded Cimabue's Virgin through the streets of our capital." So Doucet bought it, of course. How could you resist? Jean Cocteau, he wrote to Picasso this, "I'm about to go and see Apollinaire, perhaps because he's acquired that equilibrium I need, which you possess, and because of which I love you so tenderly." This is Simon Hantai in honor and homage to Reverdy, of whom I don't have a picture. It's very strange that Reverdy I cannot find a picture of. This is a poem by Reverdy to Picasso, and it's engraved on clay tablets, written in 1924. "In time's dry margin, through this bare heart that spills over bitter Picasso, seed in the wind populating deserts." Paul Éluard, a poem called Pablo Picasso. "The weapons of sleep have dug into the night, marvelous trenches keeping our heads apart. Seen through the diamond, all metals are false. The earth is invisible under the blazing sky. The face of the heart has lost its colors, and the sun seeks us out, and the snow is blind. The horizon has wings if we turn away, and looking into the distance, we dispel all faults." And I wanted finally, among this initial bunch of poems, to read you a poem by Aragon I just found and love immensely. It's called The Embrace. AD 1905, Pablo Picasso, how old was he then? 23, 24, it was spring or perhaps autumn. "What matters is that here there reigns the light of youth. A room for entwined lovers needs nothing but a bed. It was 12 years ago that I arrived, Boulevard Saint-Germain, 202, to visit Guillaume Apollinaire. From the distance came the coughing of Big Bertha. Everything took on a tight-lipped air. The stories spiraled round me on the staircase. It was like Robinson Crusoe's tree. An eye glittered in the spy hole of the door, and like a plump bird clothed in the horizon, the poet in his socks welcomed me there in his nest. So here's the enchanter. Where are the seven swords? Wounded in the head, trepanned under chloroform. I said to myself, Guillaume, it is time you came." He said to me, what did he say? And showed me round with excuses. The Picassos are in the cellar, except his hand indicated the wall where love is being made in the room next door. All the rest, oh, kiss, perpetual kiss, night and day, day and night, this long halt of the clock, and lip upon lip, and the linked breathing, and the life beyond, real the bed yet, much less real than the moment fixed upon the canvas. Are we not still in the age of silent film? Half a century later, it's still the same music, same silence in the public gardens on the benches. At the corners of the streets, in the dark bellies of the houses, alone, nothing but them alone, never weary of their embrace, trembling, held in each other's arms and legs, the lovers of 1905, may their pleasure be eternal." Picasso, as you know, wrote poetry, and he wrote poems under the inspiration of André Breton, and the poem I will read you I have in my book on Dora Maar, and it's a poem which is in the same form as André Breton's famous poem called Free Union that goes, "My love with, and all the parts of her body up and down." This goes, very Picasso, like her great thighs. Dora Maar's great thighs, right? Her great thighs, her breasts, her hips, her buttocks, her arms, her calves, her hands, her eyes, her cheeks, her hair, her nose, her throat, her tears. The planets, the wide curtain drawn in the transparent sky hidden behind the grill. The oil lamp and the little bells of the canaries sweet between the figures, the bowl of milk, of feathers snatched from each laugh, undressing the nude, removing the weight of the weapons taken from the garden flowers. So many games, dead men hanging from the branches of the schoolyard haloed with songs, lake the lure of blood and thistles, hollyhocks played in the dice, needles of liquid shadow and bouquet of crystal algae, open to the dance step of the moving colors shaken in the bottom of the glass poured out on the lilac mask, dressed with rain. Now, in the Bateau Lavoir was Max Jacob, about whom I've already spoken, and in honor of whom many of us are doing a great deal, more still, I hope. I wanted to read you just two descriptions which seemed to me to enter into the rubric of prose poems. They were in his journal, and they were about Picasso. First, he wanted to describe him. He adored him, as you probably know. Little, dark, solid, unquiet, with piercing, somber eyes, great gestures, little feet and hands, brutal disorder and anger, a table open to everyone, not made for Paris. A mattress for his friends. Are you working? Espadrilles. Old cap, much washed, a smell of dog and paint, vegetable cart chatting in front of the door, a continual procession of Spanish women. The safe, an interior pocketbook with a pin, you know that Picasso carried his money pinned to his trousers. Nice. All the dealers at five coming round, Matisse bringing Monsieur Schulkin, showed great friendliness to visitors. He cussed under his breath. And here's a description by Max Jacob of the pockets of Mr. Picasso. His pockets were mazes. First his revolver, a copper talisman, his handkerchief, one or two baggage labels, his pipe, a disorganized assembly of dirty old letters, a postcard with palette, spilled tobacco, a packet of tobacco cut like a cover with incisions on the opposite side from the band closing it, one or two used subway tickets, and some official receipts that he called the little papers, like postal receipts, convocations, and some bills. So that's Picasso's sketch of his great friend Max Jacob. And I wanted to read you John Ashbery's translation of the Rue Ravignon by Max Jacob. One does not bathe twice in the same stream, said the philosopher Heraclitus. Yet it's always the same ones who mount the street. Always at the same time of day they pass by, happy or sad. All of you passers-by of the Rue Ravignon, I've named you after the illustrious dead. There's Agamemnon. There's Madame Hanska. Ulysses is a milkman. When Patroclus appears at the end of the street, a pharaoh is beside me. Castor and Pollux are the ladies of the fifth floor. But thou, old rag picker, who come in the enchanted morning to take away the still living rubbish as I'm putting out my good big lamp, thou whom I know not, mysterious and impoverished rag picker, I have given thee a celebrated and noble name. I have named thee Dostoevsky. Bliss Sandra, this is by Modigliani. This is a text that Bliss Sandra wrote in honor of Picasso. And I think it's a very beautiful prose poem. Picasso, I know of no temperament more tormented, no mind more restless, no fingers or brushes more rapid or more subtle. His ardor, his skill, his pride, the acrobatics, the love, the cruelty, the elegance, the line, the arabesque, the perversity, the rare, the occult, the acute taste, all relate him to Gilles Doré and place his work on the same intellectual level as that of a man of letters. Neither study nor copy of reality, real absorption, contemplation, magnetism and intuition, the first liberated painter. He creates. He has the mysterious sense of correspondences and possesses the secret cipher of the world. He evokes, he transposes, he lays bare enigmatically. He insists. He points his finger. He never blinks because his eyes are transfigured by faith. He affirms life. He adores, dazzled. For he loves, and everything that comes from his hand is animated always. Above all else, he's the painter of the true, man, animal, plant, skeletal abstraction, misunderstood matter, all live, grow, suffer, couple, multiply, disappear, shift, grow again, threaten, become imperative, crystallize. He's the only man in the world who knows how to paint heat, cold, hunger, thirst, perfume, odor, fatigue, lust, envy, paralysis, palpitation, indecision, the obscure tremors of the enormous and delicate subconscious. Then his literary demon intervenes. The painter cuts, pierces, soars, stabs, rips, slashes, strangles. All at once, matter is present at the eye, enlarged by a notch. This provides us with the key to Picasso's cubism, which is not of a purely aesthetic nature, as his imitators believed it to be, but is rather an exorcism, that word keeps coming up, relation to Picasso, exorcism of a religious nature which releases the latent spiritual reality of the world. And this, again, is love. So beautiful. I want to read you two poems of Sondrail, very great poet indeed. Newspaper. Christ, it's been more than a year now since I stopped thinking about you, since I wrote my next to last poem, Easter. My life has changed a lot since, but I'm still the same. I've even wanted to become a painter. Here are the pictures I've done and which hang on the walls tonight. For me, they open strange views unto myself, which make me think of you. Christ, life, that's what I've ransacked. My paintings hurt me. I'm too passionate. Everything is oranged up. I spent a sad day thinking about my friends and reading the paper. Christ, life crucified in the wide open paper I hold at arm's length. Wings spread, rockets, turmoil, cries. You'd think an airplane is dropping. It's me. Passion, fire, cereals, newspaper. It's useless not wanting to talk about yourself. You have to cry out sometimes. I'm the other one, too sensitive. And I should just tell you, in case you don't know, his poem, Blaise Sondrail's poem called Easter, Les Pâques à New York. He wrote it in the New York Public Library, and they let him stay all night, and they gave him a pencil and paper to write. And then he walked out on Easter Day on the public library steps, and it was snowing, and he wrote this poem. And he went home, and Guillaume Apollinaire then took out all the punctuation out of his poems. One more short poem by Sondrail, At the Five Corners. To dare and make some noise, everything is color, movement, explosion, light. Life flowers at the windows of the sun, which melts in my mouth. I'm ripe, and I fall translucent in the street. You said it, buddy. I don't know how to open my eyes. Golden tongue, poetry is in play. And the last poet I'll be reading from is Apollinaire. And I wanted to read you first just two or three lines from a new translation by Peter Reed of the Cubist Painters. And I think it's an excellent translation, and I wanted to read you this. This Malagan scathed us like a sudden chill. This is Apollinaire in the Cubist Painters writing about Picasso. His meditations were laid bare in surrounding silence. He came from afar, from the rich, brutally ornate compositions of 17th century Spain. And those who knew him earlier recalled fast, exuberant works in which he'd already gone beyond just testing his powers. His persistent pursuit of beauty then changed everything into art. Surprise laughs wildly in the purity of light. And so numbers and printed letters may legitimately be used as pictorial elements, new to art and already long steeped in humanity. And now, three short poems of Apollinaire. In Picasso's studio. Always. Always, we'll go forward, never getting anywhere. And from planet to planet, the Don Juan of 1,003 comets, even staying right here, seeking new strength, taking all spirit seriously. And so many worlds lose sight of themselves. Which ones are best at forgetting? Making us forget this or that place. Where's the Columbus to whom we'll owe the loss of a continent? Losing, but really losing, to make room for the stroke of luck. Losing, losing life to find victory. And this from 1920 is called The Farewell. I picked this fragile sprig of heather. Autumn has died long since, remember. Never again shall we see one another. Odor of time, spring of heather, remember. I await our life together. On Picasso's deathbed, he was still having conversations with Apollinaire, who died years before. And Apollinaire is the only person who wrote fewer letters to Picasso than Picasso wrote to him. It was an interesting love. Finally, the poem called Windows. I'll just read some of it. The yellow fades from red to green. There's a poem to be done on the bird with only one wing. We'll send it by telephone. Periwinkles, turbot, multiple suns, and the sea urchin of the setting sun. An old pair of yellow shoes in front of the window. Towers. Towers are streets. Wells. Wells are marketplaces. Wells. Vancouver, where the train, white with snow and fires of the night, flees the winter. Oh, Paris. The yellow fades from red to green. Paris, Vancouver, hier, maintenant, New York and the Antilles. The window opens like an orange, lovely fruit of light. Thank you.
So to have ended with Apollinaire and to begin with Apollinaire, Picasso lived among the poets and then at a certain point, but later along, was to become a poet himself, and not only under the influence of Breton, but through that tremendous energy and intelligence of his own. Apollinaire's poem, or an excerpt from it, a poem called Victoire, Victory, and particularly for the last five lines here. Listen to the sea howling and moaning by itself, my voice as faithful as shadow would finally be the shadow of life, would be as unfaithful as you, O living sea. The sea that has betrayed numberless sailors swallows my great cries like drowned gods, and the sunlit sea supports nothing but the shadows cast by the outstretched wings of birds. The word is sudden, and it is a god that trembles, advance and support me. I regret all the hands that were held out to love me, but what an oasis of arms will reach for me tomorrow. Do you understand this joy of seeing new things? O voice, I speak the language of the sea, and in port I speak the night of the last taverns, I who have more heads than the Hydra of Lerna, the street where my two hands are swimming, probing the city with subtle fingers is moving, but who knows, maybe tomorrow the street will stand still, who knows what path I will take then. Imagine the railroads may be outmoded and abandoned shortly. Look, victory will be above all to see truly into the distance, to see everything up close so that everything can have a new name. Victory will be above all to see truly into the distance, to see everything up close so that everything can have a new name. Gertrude Stein, the equal of Picasso, in her case, opening up a new world of writing for many of us, and even down to the into the present. So from her, if I told him a completed portrait of Picasso, and I will try to hear Gertrude Stein's voice in my head as I read this, and can't match that. If I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Would he like it? Would Napoleon, would he like it? If Napoleon, if I told him, if I told him, if Napoleon, would he like it if I told him, if I told him, if Napoleon, would he like it if Napoleon, if Napoleon, if I told him, if I told him, if Napoleon, if Napoleon, if I told him, if I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Now, not now, and now, exactly as kings, feeling full for it, exactitude as kings, so to beseech you as full as for it, exactly or as kings, shutters shut and open, so do queens, shutters shut and shutters, and so shutters shut and shutters, and so shutters, and so shutters shut, and so shutters shut and shutters, and so shutters shut, and also, and so, and also. Exact resemblance. To exact resemblance, the exact resemblance, as a resemblance, exactly as resembling, exactly in resemblance, exactly a resemblance, exactly and resemblance. For this is so, because. Now actively repeat at all, now actively repeat at all, now actively repeat at all. Have, hold, and hear, actively repeat at all. I judge as a resemblance to him. Who comes first? Napoleon the first. Who comes to coming to? Who goes there as they go, they share? Who shares all? All is as yet or as yet. How to date? Now to date. Now and date and the date. Who came first? Napoleon at first. Who came first? Napoleon the first. Who came first? Napoleon first. Presently, exactly do they do, first exactly do they do too, first exactly and first exactly do they do, and first exactly and do they do, at first exactly and do they do, the first exactly and do they do, the first exactly at first exactly. First as first as exactly, presently, as presently, he, and he, and he, and he, and he, and as he, and as he, and he is, and as he is, and as he is, and he is, and as he, and he, and as he is, and he, and he, and he, and he, and he, and he, can curls rob, can curls quote, quotable. As presently, as exactitude, as trains, has trains, has trains, as trains, as trains, presently, proportions, presently, as proportions are presently, father and father, was a king or room, farther and weather, was there, weather and in there, as even say so, one, I land, two, I land, three, the land, three, the land, three, the land, two, I land, one, I land, two, I land, and so, they cannot, a note, they cannot, afloat, they cannot, they dote, they cannot, they as denote, miracles play fairly well, a well, as or as presently. Let me recite what history teaches. History teaches. And Picasso, I'm happy to say, was very short, you know, perhaps as short as I am, you know, and this endears him. To me, but I suppose also the reputation of Napoleon for being short, whether that's true or not, you know. And so when Napoleon comes into the poem, you know, Napoleon and Picasso, though short, you know, was a leader of men and a follower of women. So from Jacob, and you know, maybe a reflection on where they were among the poets. Together. Literary manners, one. If two groups of writers run into each other, the usual thing is to stretch out the greetings with a great many smiles. If one group runs into a stray from another, the greetings start at a high level but gradually drop off until the last one online doesn't even say hello. Well, take the time when I was supposed to have said that you had bitten some woman's nipple until you drew blood. If you really believe that I'd said it, why should you greet me? And if I really thought that you'd done it, why should I greet you? But there we were in the house of one of those fabulous ladies with eyeglasses and a knitted cape, and you impulsively reached for my hand. That was how it went until we ended up in the room with the lady's chamber pot, and you took the pillows that were piled on her nightstand and threw them at my head. The pillows were very 18th century, and rumor has it that I threw them back at you instead of explaining what I had done. Or maybe that isn't what happened. But if my group ever runs into you and I'm the last one online and don't greet you, don't think it's got anything to do with those pillows. Likewise, if my group ever runs into your group and the usual smiles are exchanged, don't think that any are coming from me. Literary manners, too. A Havana businessman sent me a cigar wrapped in gold leaf, only a little chewed at one end. The poets at my table all say that he was playing a joke on me. But the old Chinaman who invited us over reminds them that it's an old Cuban custom and a sign of great esteem. Next, I show them two magnificent poems that a friend of mine translated and wrote down for me on a scrap of paper because I said I liked them when he first read them out loud. The poets tell me that everyone knows those poems and that they really aren't worth much. But the old Chinaman says that the poets couldn't have read them before, since the only copy in the world is a rare manuscript in the Pali language, which none of them understand. Then the poets look at each other and burst out laughing like a bunch of kids, and the old Chinaman stares at us all with such sadness. So in 1935, was it Picasso began really for the first time to write poetry and to stop painting, you know, and for a year for various reasons, you know, he was not painting, although he was doing some, you know, some other art, and began to write and continued to write until 1957 or 1958. The medium for the writing was prose, and the writing itself was poetry, and the final work, unless we learn otherwise, in 1957-1958, he called The Burial of the Count of Orgaz, after the title of the great painting by El Greco, and whatever the relationship might be. This is from a section of that. And with regard to the... what seems to be the brothel elegance of Demoiselle d'Avignon. It's not a brothel poem, but it might be. July 21st, 1958. Verdigris. Toro and lamb tripes and son of a bitch and tailor for priests with the eyes of a partridge and silver and gold the nose of a rat and Alcatraz millstone and unripened fruit when his mother-in-law's letters smash the cash box to bits, hallelujah. The three daughters of the bridegroom, the weaver of shoes, got dressed in fine clothes and set out from home around 5 a.m. They grabbed hold of a buggy and all in a turmoil. They got to the farm by 9:30 that day. There was nobody waiting for them, which, if there wasn't, they would have polished the world off, would have plucked some old rag from its innards and buckled it on for the banquet. But all they could do was rip out its guts to show off the chitlins, low laughs and high masses in summer. Would head off to sing for those sugary skies and those spice cakes and bunches of jasmines got up in their feet by dint of the clouds and the fistfuls of roses stripped down to their short hairs, and with their bare fists they grabbed hold of the three glass panes on the wardrobe, the sans hangings of damask, sans funeral dirges, and step after step got soaked to the marrow. Uncle John at that hour was hanging around the cafe, sprawled out on the benches and waiting for lunchtime. The smallest of all the three sisters next stuck out her cock and pissed in the porridge, then put on her nightcap and wiped her ass clean and started to pray like a saint. And through the eye of a needle, more and more lanterns and lights were beginning to burst into bunches of stars left to dry somewhere over the ocean. Scouring brushes, fried bacon, candied almonds, and smells of sweet basil, and their curls hanging loose, belly up on the cushions, their legs fanning the sheets with ivory screams and screaming of lilies, and kisses with fingers like scissors painting the stage curtain up in the alcove dissolved in a sauce of gum arabic of the brush stroke of hot living lime falling down silently drop after drop on the bull ring. And afterwards, or a little before, underneath or on top of the roof, the candlesticks lit up the razors of swallows crisscrossing in flight, the blue of their wounds night over their heads or their tails phosphorescing the wheat they are smoking, the cheese rinds and kidneys of fleas of flags turning gold on the beach one more time. It was worse still, the judge and the priest cut a deal. They would dandle the babe in his cradle, would sing him a death song with no sense of shame, with the skin tan down to the bone, with so many scratches and kisses and pulling off yard after yard of the jackfish's scales with their mouths hanging open and the owls scratching away belly button of binges and crooked guitars, their feet getting soaked in the spurt of blood cascading down the neck of the silver fleeced lamb. From the silken cockades, from the lines tangled, shredded, and set in a milk dish and propped in the window, in the windowsill in the night air, and not even one butterfly more would gather its harvest from the slices of melon and the watermelons that the three young girls lugged on their shoulders. How ashamed it all made them to see themselves painted like rabbits, dying of laughter and fright, changed into sausages, scratching their tummies and tits, waking up early and dreaming all day and panting by night in the night air. If only their auntie could see them, Aunt Clara, the gravedigger's bride, that jerk Nicodemus, the far biggest asshole in town and still just the sweetest and neatest he is, yes, but also the poorest. So what will we do with him? What do you want us to do with him? Yes, it's all done now and there's nothing more we can say. It's all done now. The three girls are like that, and not either God or the devil will turn them around. They each have their graces, their angel, their duende, and if they should fuck, it's because they like fucking. It makes them feel good, and after they do, they can sleep and not dream, because dreaming so much, they are always awake when they dream. And thus did he say it, the man who knows who the town idiot is, who was passing his time throwing stones at the church bells or singing away in the plaza, perched somewhere over the axe blade, the thrust of the guillotine shadow with its thousands of quintals of sun of the mattress of light, kicked apart by the hoofs of the ages. And 10 years ago, I was in Paris beginning this translation with Pierre Joris that had ended up in a book of perhaps complete poems of a Picasso called The Burial of the Count of Orgaz and other poems. Paris so easily becomes the Paris of other times, in a city of cemeteries where we go, who never, some of us, and visit the burial sites even of our own families. But Paris becomes the city where graves are visited. So it seems to me, too, that because those ghosts are in Paris, that the three poets I've read from, the four, Apollinaire, Gertrude Stein, Max Jacob, and Picasso, of course, turn up in this poem. And the poem is also written, because we live in the present, during a time in Paris, when the country, as periodically happens, was in a period of recession or perhaps going into depression, and there were beggars in the street, many more than I remembered, and some of them so curiously well-dressed that this comes into the poem also. Before coming to Paris, we were with Pierre Joris and family in the Pyrenees and on a trip up the mountain on a cable car. Well, actually, a trip back down. It stopped above a chasm, 100 meters below us, so a moment of existential terror that comes into the poem also. And many friends were dying then, a condition that seems to have continued sadly into the present, but inevitably. Three Paris elegies. Into my own dark Sunday light approaches like the moon through feathers that's no sooner seen, sunk by blindness, and the thought that everyone is dead around the city that's about to vanish as it has before, sucked down an empty pocket oversized and with a smell of earth. The bright adventurers of 1910 whose streets these were, sharing a common grave with those who followed, reaching even to the place where you and I are waiting with the friends who drop out one by one like cyber monkeys flying into mindless space. Above a gorge, we hung and swayed. The mountains were alive to every side, stone witnesses. The air was still with only a distant puff of wind. We sat suspended by an iron wire, voiceless, no one to talk to in the world but you and me. That revelation, I think I prize its emptiness the most. So even now, arrived in Paris, I sit alone and feel it bursting from my chest, electric, final rush of footsteps down an empty street. Why does a well-dressed man come up to me and ask me for a handout? This is a dream, I think. It can't be real. Why does a smiling mother dressed for church reach out a hand to touch me, shadows all around her, sitting on the ground? Why does she ask for help? And why do I keep walking, walking past her, where there is no street or sun, even in Paris on this hottest day in summer? What is the sound that comes at us around the corner, sound of a wave suspended in the air of hives of bees, of hands applauding in the dark? Who is the man who wears a flower in his ear, a shirt with many folds, a vest, a beard, the buttons glowing like electric sparks? The more I search his features, I can see his lips are gone, his tongue is heavy, hanging to one side and forming words that never reach me, that the darkness covers. All the people on this street sit flat against a wall, some open-eyed, some sunk in a deep sleep. All are dressed up. The men wear business suits and blazers, a cardigan, a double-breasted jacket, a tuxedo, ties and tails, but have no hats or coats. Their shoes are simple, always a dark brown or black with marks of sand from garden walks in Paris, laces open, sometimes without socks. And the women, well-dressed too, although the hair of one is hanging limply with another's, there are open spots that show her skull. A third one has the traces of a beard, a large wet stain under one armpit. Just look at them, and they begin to talk the way that birds talk. Feathers that the wind is blowing squirrel across the square. We sit in paradise and pass a ball between us, papers at our feet. Then when it's time to leave, we walk around a corner, climb the little flight of stairs and hear them following. The rush of music from a distant time, a woman's voice becoming regular, the words emerging low and high, relentless openings, processions. And it's Picasso in the lead, a little man with hairy shoulders. He is stripped down to his running shorts like Frank O'Hara. Both of them now stars for Mineola Prep, both now declare their love of evil. With Apollinaire here too, his head no bigger than a thumbnail, flanked by Gertrude Stein, eyes like a crazy doll's, and someone looking like my father, Max Jacob, wrapped in a monk's brown cloak down which his body disappears. Here in a world where there are only little people, phantoms, where the sky is not a sky, the earth is shrinking daily under silver plastic, disappearing, slipping through my hands like balls in a pachinko parlor, eyes revolving like red lights. To end here in La République with all the other dead, the hungry ghosts under our windows, a soup kitchen for the dead, the ones who run, the ones who squat now on the grass. They speak our frailty, the doom built into life, decomposition, chaos, anarchy, confusion, worse, confounded, helter, skelter, squalor, out of whack and out of order, out of kilter, out of money, out of time and out of place and out of breath and out of work and out of hope and out of power, because the men who come to us, though dead, are just like us and stare at us like fallen princes. We welcome you to death, they say, their looks dividing us in two. The numbers dance again behind our eyes. The circles break. The man holding a clock up to his ear will count the silence. Every day is summer. What was once alive is gone. And what has yet to be alive is also gone.
I want to thank Anna Swinburne and Laura Bailes for putting this program together and for including me in it. I'm going to read, to begin, two poems by Baudelaire. I've read that André Breton said that the painting Les Demoiselles d'Avignon was an explosion in the laboratory, and Baudelaire is another explosion in the laboratory of poetry. Hymn to Beauty. Do you come from on high or out of the abyss, O beauty? Godless yet divine, your gaze indifferently showers favor and shame, and yet some have likened you to wine. Your eyes reflect the sunset and the dawn. You scatter perfumes like a windy night. Your kisses are a drug, your mouth the urn, dispensing fear to heroes, fervor to boys. Whether spawned by hell or sprung from the stars, fate like a spaniel follows at your heel. You sow haphazard fortune and despair, ruling all things, responsible for none. You walk on corpses, beauty, undismayed, and horror coruscates among your gems. Murder, one of your dearest trinkets, throbs on your shameless belly. Make it dance. Dazzled, the dayfly flutters round your wick, crackles, flares, and cries, I bless this torch. The pining lover for his lady swoons like a dying man adoring his own tomb. Who cares if you come from paradise or hell, appalling beauty, artless and monstrous scourge, if only your eyes, your smile, or your foot reveal the infinite I love and have never known. Come from Satan, come from God, who cares? Angel or siren, rhythm, fragrance, light, provided you transform, O my one queen, this hideous universe, this heavy hour. This next poem is a prose poem, also Baudelaire, The Favors of the Moon. The moon, who is caprice itself, looked through the window while you were sleeping in your cradle and said to herself, I like this child. And softly she descended her staircase of clouds and noiselessly passed through the window panes. Then she stretched herself out over you with the supple tenderness of a mother and laid down her colors on your face. Ever since, the pupils of your eyes have remained green and your cheeks unusually pale. It was while contemplating this visitor that your eyes became so strangely enlarged, and she clasped your neck so so tenderly that you have retained forever the desire to weep. However, in the expansion of her joy, the moon filled the whole room like a phosphorescent vapor, like a luminous poison, and all the living light thought and said, you shall suffer forever the influence of my kiss. You shall be beautiful in my fashion. You shall love that which I love and that which loves me. Water, clouds, silence, and the night, the immense green sea, the formless and multiform streams, the place where you shall not be, the lover whom you shall not know, flowers of monstrous shape, perfumes that cause delirium, cats that shudder, swoon, and curl up on pianos and groan like women with a voice that is hoarse and gentle. And you shall be loved by my lovers, courted by my courtiers. You shall be the queen of all men that have green eyes, whose necks also I have clasped in my nocturnal caresses, of those who love the sea that is immense, tumultuous, and green, the formless and multiform streams, the place where they are not, the woman whom they do not know, sinister flowers that resemble the censures of a strange religion, perfumes that confound the will, and the savage and voluptuous animals that are the emblems of their dementia. And that, my dear, cursed, spoiled child, is why I'm now lying at your feet, seeking in all your person the reflection of the formidable divinity, of the foreknowing godmother, the poisoning wet nurse of all the lunatics. Now I'm just going to read a couple of snippets from the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas by Gertrude Stein, and this is from Chapter 2, 1907 to 1914. And you have to remember it's Alice who's presumably speaking. We left them and continued to climb higher in the hill. "What did you think of what you saw?" asked Miss Stein. "Well, I did see something." "Sure you do. You did," she said. "But did you see what it had to do with those two pictures you sat in front of so long at the vernissage?" "Only that Picasso's were rather awful, and the other ones were not." "Sure," she said, "as Pablo once remarked, when you make a thing, it is so complicated making it that it is bound to be ugly. But those that do it after you, they don't have to worry about making it, and they can make it pretty. And so everybody can like it when the others make it." And later on, "Picasso and Ferdinand came to dinner. Picasso in those days was what a dear friend and schoolmate of mine, Nellie Jacquot, called a good-looking bootblack. He was thin, dark, alive, with big pools of eyes in a violent but not rough way. He was sitting next to Gertrude Stein at dinner, and she took up a piece of bread. 'This,' said Picasso, snatching it back with violence, 'this piece of bread is mine.' She laughed, and he looked sheepish. That was the beginning of their intimacy. That evening, Gertrude Stein's brother took out portfolio after portfolio of Japanese prints to show Picasso. Gertrude Stein's brother was fond of Japanese prints. Picasso solemnly and obediently looked at print after print and listened to the descriptions. He said under his breath to Gertrude Stein, 'He's very nice, your brother, but like all Americans, like Haviland, he shows you Japanese prints. Moi, j'aime pas ça. No, I don't care for it.' As I say, Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso immediately understood each other. As I said when I became a habitual visitor to the Rue de Fleurus, the Picassos were once more together, Pablo and Fernand. That summer they went again to Spain, and he came back with some Spanish landscapes, and one may say that these landscapes, two of them still at the Rue de Fleurus and the other one in Moscow at the collection that Schuchheim founded and that is now national property, were the beginning of Cubism. In these, there was no African sculpture influence. There was evidently a strong Cézanne influence, particularly the influence of the late Cézanne watercolors, the cutting up the sky not in cubes but in spaces. But the essential thing, the treatment of the houses, was essentially Spanish and therefore essentially Picasso. In these pictures, he first emphasized the way of building in Spanish villages, the line of the houses not following the landscape but cutting across and into the landscape, becoming undistinguishable in the landscape by cutting across the landscape. It was the principle of the camouflage of the guns and the ships in the war. The first year of the war, Picasso and Yves, with whom he was living then, Gertrude Stein and myself, were walking down the Boulevard Raspail a cold winter evening. There is nothing in the world colder than the Raspail on a cold winter evening. We used to call it the retreat from Moscow. All of a sudden down the street came some big cannon, the first any of us had seen painted, that is, camouflaged. Pablo stopped. He was spellbound. "C'est nous qui avons fait ça," he said. "It is we that have created that," he said. And he was right. He had. From Cézanne, through him, they had come to that. His foresight was justified. And now, in humility, after quoting Stein and Baudelaire, two poems by me. One is called Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. Over here our story begins, and over there it continues, like the idle hum of the clown car. What a pity, says the cat, that the corporal occupies the moment, the forever echoes, the electroencephalograph echoes. See this curtain? It's the framework of an empty narrative. The arc is gone, but the body remains. Behind the curtain, someone is handing you a graphic, a cartoon quarter hour. Decay is crumbling away. What are we to do with this end piece of a legacy but assume the self is the mask in a story made of fragments, color-coded, ballooned, or cubed, a veritable cataclysm, a glass globe shattering the basis of the shaken one-point perspective. At the core of the laboratory, a field of vision, a force of ellipsis, a bevy of bare legs, five pairs, like those seen on television as an open and closed case of syncopated swimming, where five bodies become one in a body of aqua water. There's also taffy apple oil with underdrawing, drawing us all in under the past pattern of clouds in motion over a medium blue conveyor belt ocean. Five dolls are looking out on an unfeeling world. If they could, they might wish us well in our futile pursuit of happiness. Have fun, they might say, with your foolish Madeleine cakes, your dilute tea. Unlike us, they're lucky. They have nothing to do but enjoy standing there, naked, feeling relieved of the gravity of the body, idle minds into which, in an idle moment, all will fall. The present, the future, the stage curtain, which is slightly moth-eaten, and the ocean skimmed over with ice. This last poem is after Eric Heckel's Masks, a woodcut printed in black, also made in 1907, the same year as Les Demoiselles. M as in masks. The psychic investiture of a seal, an impression badly done of some other who presented one morning as a caricature of a crying doll in a cradle with Freud leaning over a mirror and seeing only the bottom of his beard. Why do we? And one day not, yet, or not always, or not ever. The body as document burning in an ashtray, the scene in front changing, a flipbook feeling the current in front of it, ions on a sofa, a sanguine moment at 30 of and after, a document, sturdy, unpatented, private prosthesis partly dispatched into a pocket, at a structure of obligation, a cultural ditto, unstable signifier. The wearer is something, the color and the feel of fabric. Thank you.
Good evening. André Salmon was a poet. He was maybe a minor poet, but he was a major friend of the painters. And when he was not hanging in the ateliers of Picasso and company, he was in the beer halls drinking beer, playing cards, and writing some poems. Here are two of his poems. The first one is from the 1907 volume, Féerie, Enchantments. It's called Perpetual Enchantment. They asked me if work came easy to me, and although they are not imbeciles, what they asked me reeked of stupidity. You can tell they never were, nor never will be, poets. It is said that Saint-Louis de Donzange was so afraid of vice he didn't dare look at his mother. Come on, don't weep, tears are bitter, I'll buy you another ring. I would love for the pale fingers of a queen to soothe my forehead buzzing like a hive full of horrible insects that killed off the bees and that pierced my eardrums to escape. When the time comes to prepare the repast, you'll blow on the fire that delights the poets, hunkered down like a witch, and you'll get angry, believing that witches are always old and ugly. You say you'd like to have a piano? I'd love to own a domain with a beautiful water fountain in the middle of a basin in a French garden where naked young girls would dance to English tunes. There are days when one doesn't even feel like weeping. One no longer has a favorite poet. There remains the leisure of informing oneself in detail on the heroic customs of sad spiders. If I were the king of Spain, I'd have a guitar. If I were a sailor, I'd hope for a lighthouse. If I were my mistress, I'd have a lover who wouldn't want, alas, to be loved hopelessly. And from a later volume called Peindre, to paint, Oh, Place Clichy, oh, square of Anvers, reflected games of an upside-down world. Oh, our youth, wages made good, bets won, our lost hours, oh, youthful years. We made a solid choir to deck out the empty night with tunes of our fashioning. Benard, Bonnard, Vuillard, Volard. Apollinaire laughed into the hollow of his hand. Keyes came from Amsterdam to check out the girls, took pleasure with them, and learned his lesson. Linen, satin and flesh, brightness. Derain, who knew everything. And Picasso, marveling, blue period, pink period. The sky, stamped with the signs of an imperious decree, the sky in which you read Jacob as if in a novel, the sky, canvas of weights and measures, the sky, signature of our usurer, the sky, sailor and storms, where the painter rigged the poet's vessel, where so many sunken and named ships resuscitated, and all these numbers. Treasure of the real, our only possession. How we were counting on this Cypriot sea, oh Cyprian. Apollinaire was laughing in the hollow of his hand. Picasso crowned a marvelous child. The most tired one leaned on Derain's arm, and Marie Laroncin, in a titmouse dress, Diane and Geneviève de Brabant, with a song, reopened the eyes of the angels, as well as those of lost lovers asleep on a bench. God doesn't exist except if you adore him. Time is nothing except what one has dreamt. How many dawns have we made rise? O enlarged worlds of our wise intoxications, O fatherlands pulled from nothingness, O Rue des Abbesses, O Rue Ravignan. That was André Salmon. And now for some light and pleasant Guillaume Apollinaire. He wrote a book that came out in 1911, but that was written from, say, 1907 on, called Le Bestiaire ou Cortège d'Orphée. And these are 12 beasts and 2 Orpheuses. The serpent. You harass beauty. Just look at all those women who were your victims. Eve, Eurydice, Cleopatra, and I know 3 or 4 more. The cat. For my house I want a woman of sound mind, a cat prowling among the books, friends for all seasons. Without these I cannot live. The lion. O lion, unhappy image of kings miserably fallen, you're now born only in a cage in Hamburg among the Germans. The hare. Don't be lascivious and fearful like the hare and the one who's in love. But may your brain always be the pregnant doe hare that conceives. The rabbit. I know another coney that I'd love to catch alive. Its warrens amidst the thyme in the valleys of the land of tenderness. The dromedary. With his 4 dromedaries, Don Pedro d'Alfarubera traveled the world in awe. He did what I would do had I but 4 dromedaries. The mouse. Beautiful days. Time's mice. You nibble and gnaw my life. God, soon 28 years, badly lived, as it pleases me. The elephant. As the elephant has his ivory, so do I have something precious in my mouth. Scarlet death. I buy my glory with the coin of melodious words. Orpheus 1. Look at that disgusting whirl. With 1,000 legs, 100 eyes, rotifers, mites, insects, and microbes more marvelous than the 7 wonders of the world and the palace of Rosemont. The caterpillar. Work makes for riches. Poor poets, get a job. Through ceaseless labor, the caterpillar becomes the rich butterfly. The fly. Our flies know songs taught them in Norway by the Gannic flies that are the divinities of the snow. The flea. Fleas, friends, lovers even. How cruel those who love us. All our blood flows for them. Unhappy, those who are well-loved. Orpheus 2. May your heart be the bait and heaven the swimming pool. For, fishermen, what sweet or saltwater fish does he equal in shape or taste, this beautiful divine fish called Jesus, my Savior? And finally, the squid, throwing its ink at the skies, sucking the blood of what he loves, and finding it delicious. This inhuman monster, that's me, I, myself. They're little known, those poems of Apollinaire's, and it's a really kind of pleasure to do. Here is a poem kind of written for the occasion around the photographer, ex-painter photographer, Edward Steichen, and it's called A Letter to Steichen's Ed, as we would say in Luxembourgish. It's a poem by myself, and I put an epigraph on it that has absolutely nothing to do with the poem, but I really like the quote. It goes, "In fact, every photograph is a fake from start to finish, a purely impersonal, unmanipulated photograph being practically impossible." Edward Steichen. Leven it. Ich weiß nicht, ob du uns Spruch nach gekannt hast, and that's why I'll address you in American English. You were born to Beve by Reza in Luxembourg. I was not. You were an American citizen. I am still not. I'm just plain a citizen of Luxembourg. You believed in the family of man. I'm weary of families of any order and species. But you are family. In that photo by Dana, those clear blue Luxembourg eyes, exactly like Cousin Lolt's. The cut of the face, too. There's a resemblance, close to the bone, close to the farm, a way in which the head is held, high and loose. You're my homeboy of old, Ed, a cousin, maybe even cousin germain, as the French would say. Now, you burnt your paintings when your gardener imitated one of yours. A strange act, a criticism of the representation of representation, maybe? Or just a cheap trick to prove Duchamp wrong for saying stupide comme un peintre, and move on to the new technologies. Now, I never burned a single poem, have kept them all, but then you had Carl Sandburg in the family, devoted companion for long walks and writing for you. I have always hated taking photos, but bought a camera at 60 to shoot landscapes and a family of one Joris and half a dozen friends, but I always leave it home or forget it in my pocket. You were a famous delphinium breeder. I only brood over words, make poems and make anthologies, weird cut flower bouquets. I'm in Albany, New York, and sometimes visit Buffalo, where you did avant-garde color autochromes the year Ford introduced the Model T Ford, and 1 year after Picasso painted the Demoiselle. Ah, the autochrome, hot off the 1903 minds of the Frères Lumière. Then I've seen the Light Brothers, first marketed in our year 1907. It is an additive method, a process involving millions of microscopic grains of potato starch. Did you ever think of the Luxembourg staple food, Gromper, when you loaded the camera? Dyed bright blue-violet, bright orange-red, and Kelly green, dusted on a slightly concave piece of glass, already coated with liquid pitch mixed with a dram of beeswax to keep it tacky. The random spaces filled with lamp black and panchromatic silver halide emulsion. The resultant screen was stochastic in nature, a random array, an abstraction way beyond the demoiselle's demure cubism, though the light you let pass through the photosensitive plate coming off your subjects, say Charlotte Spalding in Buffalo, with the starch grains remaining as aligned as the starch of her lacy dress, organized this randomness into plain Edwardian beauty. Ed, you were not Edwardian. You were just a Luxembourg lad in America who made good and moved with ease between Condé Nast and this here place, 50 years before Warhol. If I am trying so hard to understand this autochrome process, of which you said no medium can give me color of such wonderful luminosity, it is because you also said, if you don't take doors off their hinges, how are you going to know to put the doors back on their hinges? So that, Cousin Ed, may be where we disagree. Why put the doors back on the hinges? Beauty will bolt anyway, and all we are left with is the beauty of doing the work, the handwork, the hands-on work. Your plates, my words. Merci, cousin. Das Gute Wissen, dass du hier warst, für mir. A couple days ago in the New York Times, you may have seen, they found a couple of new plates that had disappeared, that were found in Buffalo, in fact, of exactly Charlotte Spalding. And I'll close, we'll close with Pablo Picasso, of course. As Jerry told you, he started writing in 35 and really wrote for the rest of his life. And he was very proud to be a poet. He is reported to have said to a friend, long time after my death, they will put on my gravestone, here lies Pablo Ruiz Picasso, poet, who also dabbled in paint. So here are some poems from 1936. April 23rd, 1936. 1. Bugle call. There we are. It's the arm that does it, right? Bugle call of the harp stuck in the mud in the middle of the road. No exit, octopus fastened to the core of the warm, bald source of the river of feathers, earth welded, head lowered. 2. Dissolved in the flakes, heart shoved in. No exit to the octopus fastened to the road in the river of feathers, boils in the source, the earth is lowered head. 3. To the helmet taken to heart, octopus shoved into the harp. The road, warm ball of the river of feathers, fastened earth, is lowered head. The next day, i.e. 24th of April, 36. Legs in the air, the rainbow in the middle of the starry night, wringing its linens, cradle with astonished eyes, pure goldfish from the blinking hammock of the games, round of nails hammered into the fire at the prism's throat, rope held by the ends at the burns of the mudstag wheel in the pond, biting with rage the eye of the expiring bull. 28th of April. Venus, having left her flat to buy sardines in oil from the grocery, suffers sunstroke, becomes a shell. Sheet of mauve silk paper, a kind of Venus, leaving her flat by chance in the morning in her little everyday dress, feet naked in her slippers, unkempt grease stains on the sleeves, buys sardines in oil from the grocers, a flute song on the electric chair forgotten in the Venetian blinds, shaking her body to the sound of these swear words, becomes seen under the magnifying glass, a kind of shell, if the tone, the sea lends, the scream glazier carries off with its tongue, the bitterness of the artichoke leaf, and with the foot kicks the ear of the marshmallow curtain that glues its mouth to the pane, the oil drop broke, and through its wing sees the dream of its geometric wound, for and against sharp angle of the crystal locked into the mathematically illusory perfume, stolen from the blind sunbeam, holding out its hands to catch the smoking platter of potatoes on the table on horseback, on the blue thread flying among the garden flowers this afternoon, April 28th of the year 1966, 36, where the great hedgehoggy happiness serves as ball to bat around and to repaint the rainbow locked into the water glass at the stroke of hope given to the avalanche of eyes racing at top speed along the lacy edge of the salt mountain established at the bottom of the cloud of the orange tree, flowers arriving at the pace of rain biting the lips of the masked ball fixed to the granite wall by the rosy thorns, wax figures, their face covered with gobs of spit. The next day, All lines removed from the painting that represents the image of a young girl's head appears floating around a wide aroma of blows hitting the sky's shoulder, pride, white cheese, poppies, white wine, fried at the pigeon shoot of the white fife-player, yellow yell of whips reflected by the flight of a swallow over the eye of mauve silk nettle-winged horse at the end of the yellow foam, at the white corsage of the mauve pick, pipe penciled streak with goat's leaps, white star, mauve yellow spread at the edge of the moon, mauve dish of flageolets, arc bent at iris yellow, cobalt blue, indigo blue, in the mauve nets of slate yellow to feather white blue, put rope to neck, mauve yellow dove, at worst decapitated blue, bites mauve hand yellow lake, at white lip blue, detachable collar rat devouring the mauve. Ear of corn, yellow, blue, mauve, yellow, blue, 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 blue line wrapping its spiral. The bridge stretches, arriving first and breathless in the target center. 4th of May. All the shredded shadows peel off the bodies with the haste of the start of a journey, and faithful to their appointment with light, they spread out in the smoky thickness of the crystal, spiraling downward to the bottom of the ocean of their kingdom. Here's her story. I was born to a white father and a small glass of Andalusian eau de vie. I was born to an unmarried mother, a girl of 15, born in Malaga, in the perchlis, the beautiful toro who engendered me, the forehead crowned with jasmines, with his teeth had torn from his hands the lines of the cage that imprisoned the people, birds of prey with beak and claw, tearing the naked shoulder of the lemon trees, flower girl dead from fright, broken wings, blue heart striped with red in spirals, with eyes of a night moth wrapped in the apple green silk paper of a dress and shoed with pointy owl ears, leaps from one wave to the other and bounces on the foam, the marble bed of the enormous mutilated statue planted in the stand at the water's edge. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you to all of our poets. It was wonderful to listen, and thank you to Anna for the exhibition. Thank you.